Side 4, Time's Eye, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter, continuing on page 138. At length, Hephaestion acknowledged Eumenes.
You're early today, Secretary.
I don't think so. Not unless the sun has begun to jump around the sky again.
Then I must be late.
Ah! He waved a meat-laden skewer at Eumenes.
Try some of this. You'd never think a dead camel could taste so good.
The reason the Indians spice their food so heavily, Eumenes said, is because they eat rotten meat. I'll stick to fruit and mutton.
You really are a bore, Eumenes,
Hephaestion said tensely. Eumenes bit back his irritation. Despite his endless rivalry with Hephaestion, he thought he understood the Macedonian's mood.
And you missed the king. I take it there has been no word.
Half our scouts don't even return.
Does it comfort you to lose yourself between the thighs of a page?
You know me too well, Secretary.
Hephaestion dropped the skewer back on the plate.
Perhaps you're right about these spices. Still, they cut a passage through the gut like the companion cavalry through Persian lines.
He clambered off his couch, stripped off his nightshirt, and pulled on a clean tunic. This Macedonian was a contradiction, Eumenes had always thought. He was taller than most, with regular features, though a rather long nose, startling blue eyes, and close-cropped black hair. He held himself well, but there was no doubt he was a warrior, as the many scars on his body attested. Everybody knew that Hephaestion had been the king's closest companion since they were boys, and his lover since adolescence. Though the king had since taken wives, mistresses, and other lovers, the latest being the worm-like Persian eunuch Bagoas, he had once, drunk, confided in Eumenes that he always regarded Hephaestion as the only true companion, the only true love of his life. The king, no fool even when it came to his friends, had put Hephaestion in command of this army group, and before that made him his kiliarch, that is, his vizier in the Persian style. And as for Hephaestion, there were no others, none but the king. His pages and other concubines were no more than ciphers to warm him when the king was away. Hephaestion said now as he dressed,
"Does it give you satisfaction to see me suffer over the king?"
"No," Eumenes said. "I fear for him too, Hephaestion, and not just because he is my king, not because of the devastation his loss would cause in all our lives, but for him. You can believe that or not, but it's nevertheless true." Hephaestion eyed him. He went to his bath, took a flannel, and dabbed at his face.
"I don't doubt you, Eumenes. After all, we have been through a great deal together, following the king on his great adventure."
"To the ends of the earth," Eumenes said softly.
"The ends of the earth, yes. But now, who knows, perhaps even beyond. Give me a moment more. Please, sit. Have some water, wine, fruit."
Eumenes sat and took some dried figs. It had indeed been a long journey, he thought. And how strange, how disappointing, if it was all to end here, in this desolate place, so far from home. With Iron Age soldiers pointing spears at their back, Pisessa, Cecil de Morgan, Corporal Batson, and their three sepoy companions climbed over a final ridge. The delta of the Indus opened up before them, a plain striped by the glimmering surface of the broad, sluggish river. On the western horizon, Bessessa could make out the profiles of ships on the sea, made indistinct by the dense, misty air. The ships looked like triremes, she thought, wondering. Before her, an army camp was laid out. Tents had been set up along the riverbanks, and the smoke of countless fires coiled up into the morning air. Some of the tents were huge and had open fronts like shops. Everywhere there was movement, a steady churning. They weren't just soldiers. Women walked slowly, many heavily laden, children ran over the muddy ground, and dogs, chickens, and even pigs scampered through the churned-up lanes. Farther out, big enclosures held horses, camels, and mules, and flocks of sheep and goats fanned out over the marshy land. Everybody and everything was muddy, from the loftiest camel to the smallest child. De Morgan, despite mud and weariness, seemed exhilarated. Thanks to his wasted education, he knew a lot more than she did about what was going on here. He pointed to the open tents.
"See that? The soldiers were expected to buy their provisions, and so you have these traders, many of them Phoenicians, if I remember correctly, following after the marching troops. There are all sorts of emporia, traveling theaters, even courts to administer justice. And remember, this army has been in the field for years. Many of the men have acquired mistresses, wives, even children on the way. This is truly a traveling city.
The assessor was prodded in the back by a Macedonian's long iron-tipped spear, his Sarissa, as De Morgan had called it. Time to move on. They began to plod down the ridge toward the camp. She tried to hide her fatigue. At Captain Grove's request, she had set off with a scouting party to try to make contact with this Macedonian army. After several days' hike down the valley of the Indus, at dawn that morning they had given themselves up to a Macedonian patrol, hoping to be taken to the commanders. Since then, they had been marched maybe 10 clicks. Soon they were in among the tents, and Vasessa found herself picking her way over churned-up mud and dung. The animal stink was overwhelming. It was more like a farmyard than a military camp. They were soon surrounded by people who stared at Vasessa's flight suit, De Morgan's morning suit, and the glaring red serge jackets of the British troops. Most of the people were short, shorter even than the 19th-century sepoys. But the men were broad, stocky, obviously powerfully strong. The soldiers' tunics had been recut and patched, and even the leather tents showed signs of wear and repair. But the soldiers' shields shone, gilded, and even the horses had silver bits in their mouths. It was a peculiar mixture of shabbiness and wealth. The assessor could see that this army had been a long time away from home, but it had been successful, acquiring wealth beyond its soldiers' dreams. De Morgan seemed more interested in Bessessa's reaction than in the Macedonians themselves. "What are you thinking?" "I'm telling myself that I'm really here," she said slowly. "I am really seeing this. That 23 centuries have somehow been peeled back. And I'm thinking of all the people back home who would have loved to be here to see this."
"Yes, but at least we are here. And that's something."
Bessessa stumbled and was rewarded with another prod from the Sarissa. She said softly, "You know, I have a pistol in my belt." The Macedonians, as they had anticipated, had not recognized the party's firearms and had let them keep them, while confiscating knives and bayonets. "And I am very tempted to take off the safety and make my escort here shove that pointed chip off his own Iron Age arse."
"I wouldn't advise it," De Morgan said equably.
When Hephaestion was ready to face the day, Eumenes had his chamberlain bring forward the muster rolls and conduct sheets. This paperwork was spread out over a low table. As they spent most mornings, Eumenes and Hephaestion began to work through the endless details of administering an army of tens of thousands of men. The strengths of the army's various units, the distribution of pay, reinforcements, arms, armor, clothing, baggage animals, work that went on even when an army had been static for so many weeks, like this one. In fact, the task was made more complicated than usual by the demands of the fleet that stood idle in the mouth of the delta. As always, the report of the Secretary of Cavalry was especially troublesome. Horses died in huge numbers, and it was the duty of provincial governors across the empire to procure replacements and dispatch them to the various remount centers from where they would be sent to the field. But with the continuing lack of communication, there had been no resupply for some time. And the cavalry secretary, growing worried, recommended a sequestration from the local population.
"If any fit horses can be found outside the cooking pot,"
Hephaestion joked grimly. Hephaestion was commander of this army group, but Eumenes, as royal secretary, had his own hierarchy that ran in parallel to the army's command structure. He had subsidiary secretaries attached to each of the main army units, the infantry, the cavalry, the mercenaries, and others, each assisted by inspectors who did much of the detailed information gathering. Eumenes prided himself on the accuracy and currency of his information. Quite an achievement in the service of Macedonians, most of whom, even the nobility, were illiterate and innumerate. But Eumenes was well equipped for the task. Older than most of the king's close companions, he had served the king's father Philip as well as the son. Philip had seized Macedon 3 years before the birth of his heir. In those days, the kingdom had been a loose coalition of feuding principalities, under threat from the barbarian tribes to the north and the devious Greek city-states to the south. Under Philip, the northern tribes had soon been subdued. A confrontation with the Greeks had been inevitable. And when it had come, Philip's crucial military innovation, a highly trained, highly mobile cavalry division called the Companions, had sliced through the Greek's slow-moving hoplite infantry. Eumenes, himself a city-state Greek from Cardia, knew that resentment against the Greeks' barbarian conquerors was unlikely ever to fade. But in a time when civilization was limited to a few pockets surrounded by great seas of barbarism and the unknown, the more politically aware of the Greeks knew that a strong Macedon shielded them from worse dangers. They lauded Philip's wider ambition to invade the immense empire of Persia, ostensibly in order to revenge earlier Persian atrocities against Greek cities. And the education of the king's son at the hands of Greek tutors, including the famous Aristotle, pupil of Plato, had served to reinforce an impression of Philip's Hellenism. It had been just as Philip was preparing for his great Persian adventure that he had been assassinated. The new king was just 20, but he had shown no hesitation in continuing where his father had left off. A series of rapid campaigns had consolidated his position in Macedonia and Greece. Then he had turned his attention to the prize that had been almost in Philip's grasp. The Persian Empire sprawled from Turkey to Egypt and Pakistan, and its great king could field forces that could number a million. But after 6 years of a short, brutal, and brilliant campaign, the king of Macedon had mounted the throne of Persepolis itself. This king had not wanted simply to conquer, but to rule. He had sought to spread Greek culture through Asia. He had planted or rebuilt cities to the Greek model throughout his empire. And more controversially, he had tried to weld together the disparate people who now came under his rule. He had adopted Persian dress and mannerisms, and shocked his men by kissing Bagoas the eunuch on the lips in their sight. Meanwhile, Eumenes' own career had advanced with the king's. His efficiency, intelligence, and political subtlety had earned him the king's undying confidence. And his responsibilities had swollen with the growing empire, until Eumenes felt as if he was carrying the burden of a world on his shoulders. But a mere empire was not enough for this king. With Persia won, he had launched his battle-hardened army, all 50,000 of them, to the south and west, toward the rich, mysterious prize of India. They headed ever east into unexplored and unmapped country, heading for a coast that would, the king believed, be the shore of the ocean that ran around the world. The country was strange. There were crocodiles in the rivers and forests full of gigantic snakes. And there were rumors of empires nobody had ever heard of before. But the king would not stop. Why did he go on? Some said he was a god in mortal flesh, and the ambitions of gods transcended those of men. Some said that he sought to ape the achievements of the great hero Achilles. There was curiosity, too. A man who had been tutored by Aristotle could not help but grow up with a deep desire to know the world. But Eumenes suspected the truth was simpler. This king was his illustrious father's creation, and it was no wonder that the new king had wanted to eclipse his father's very ambitions, and so to prove himself the greater man. At last, at the river Bias, the troops, exhausted from years of campaigning, had rebelled, and even the god king could go no further. Eumenes believed that the men's gut wisdom was sound. Enough was enough. They would do well to hold what had already been taken. Besides, on a deep level of his sophisticated mind, Eumenes was subtly calculating his own advantage. He had always faced rivalries in the court, the Macedonian contempt for the Greek, the fighting man's derision of mere scribes, and Eumenes' very competence were enough to make him many enemies. Hephaestion particularly was notoriously jealous of anybody who had his lover's confidence. Often the tensions among the king's companions could be lethal, but Eumenes had survived. And he was not without his own ambitions. As the emphasis of the king's reign turned from conquest to political and economic consolidation, Eumenes' more subtle skills might find greater purchase, and he intended to be well-placed to advance his own position beyond that of a mere secretary. After that reverse at the Bias, the king still had one grand ambition, though. Still deep in India, he built an immense fleet to be sailed down the Indus and then along the coast of the Persian Gulf, intending to establish a new trade route that might further unify his empire. He had split his forces. Hephaestion was to take the fleet to the mouth of the delta, followed by the baggage train and the king's prized elephants. Eumenes and his staff had traveled with the fleet. The king himself stayed behind to campaign against rebellious tribesmen in his new Indian province. All had gone well until the king had taken on a people called the Malawi and their fortress city of Multan. The king, with typical daring, had led the attack himself, but he had taken an arrow in the chest. The last dispatch Hephaestion had received had reported that the wounded king was to be placed on a ship and floated down the river to join the rest of the fleet, while his army followed later. But that had been days ago. It was as if the world-conquering army upriver had utterly disappeared. And the sky had been full of unimaginably strange portents. Some of the men muttered that they had seen the sun itself lurch across the sky. Such strange signs could only signify a huge and terrible event. And what could that be but the death of the God-King? Eumenes believed more in hard facts than any number of omens, but it was hard for him to decipher this information, or rather the lack of it, and unease grew steadily. Still, the unrelenting routine of running the army was a distraction from the greater uncertainty of the situation. Eumenes and Hephaestion had to deal with contentious issues that could not be resolved at lower levels of the bureaucracy. Today they turned to the case of a commander of a division of foot companions who, on discovering his favorite prostitute in the bed of a fellow officer, had lopped off the man's nose with his dagger. "It's a nasty little case," said Eumenes, "which sets a bad example. But it's more complicated than that. This is a shameful act." So it was. Such disfiguring had been meted out on the king's orders, for example, to an assassin of the defeated Darius, great king of Persia. "And I know these men," Hephaestion went on. "Rumor has it they were lovers, too. Somehow this girl has come between them, perhaps hoping to profit by turning one against another." He rubbed his long nose. "Who is the girl, by the by?" It was a good question. It wasn't impossible for members of resentful, defeated peoples to work their way into the command structure of the king's army, to do as much damage as they could. Eumenes riffled through his scrolls. But before he could find the answer, Hephaestion's usher came bustling in. "Sir, you must come. The strangest thing, the strangest people." Hephaestion snapped. "Is it news of the king?"
"I don't know, sir. Oh, come, come."
Hephaestion and Eumenes glanced at each other, and they stood carelessly toppling the table with its scrolls and hurried out. Hephaestion snatched up his sword on the way. Bisessa and De Morgan were brought to a grander collection of tents, though no less mud-spattered than the rest. Severe-looking guards, armed with spears and stabbing swords, stood at the entrance, glaring at them. Bisessa's escort stepped forward and began to jabber in his fast Greek. One of the guards nodded curtly, stepped into the first tent, and spoke to somebody within. De Morgan was tense, edgy, excited. A state he got into, Bisessa had learned, when he sensed opportunity. She tried to keep herself calm. More guards in subtly different uniforms came pouring out of the tent. They surrounded Bisessa and the others, their swords pointed at the travelers' bellies. Then out came two figures, obviously more senior. They wore military-looking tunics and cloaks, but their clothes were clean. One of these commanders, the younger, came pushing through the guards. He had a broad face, a long nose, short dark hair. He looked them up and down and peered up into their faces. Like his troops, he was shorter than any of the moderns. He seemed tense, gaunt, unhappy to Bisessa, but his body language was so alien it was hard to be sure. He stood before De Morgan and yelled in his face. De Morgan quailed, flinching from the rain of spittle, and stammered a reply. Bisessa hissed, "What does he want?" De Morgan frowned, concentrating.
"To know who we are, I think. His accent is thick. His name is Hephaestion. I asked him to slow down. I said my Greek was poor. So it is. The stuff I was taught to parrot at Winchester wasn't much like this."
Now the other commander stepped forward. He was evidently older, bald, save for a frosting of silver hair, and his face was softer, narrow. Shrewd, Bisessa thought. He put his hand on Hephaestion's shoulder and spoke to De Morgan in more measured tones. De Morgan's face lit up.
"Oh, thank God, a genuine Greek! His tongue is archaic, but at least he can speak it properly, unlike these Macedonians."
So, with a double translation through De Morgan and the older man, who was called Eumenes, Bisessa was able to make herself understood. She gave their names and pointed back up the valley of the Indus.
"We are with an army detachment," she said. "Far up the valley." "If that is true, we should have encountered you before," snapped Eumenes.
She didn't know what to say. Nothing in her life that prepared her for an incident like this. Everything was strange. Everything about these people from the depths of time. They were short, grimy, vigorous, powerfully muscled. They seemed closer to the animal than the human. She wondered how they saw her. Humanis stepped forward. He walked around Bessessa, fingering the fabric of her clothes. His fingers lingered over the butt of Bessessa's pistol, and she tensed. But happily, he left it alone.
Nothing about you is familiar.
But everything is different now. She pointed to the sky. You must have seen it. The sun, the weather. Nothing is as it was before. We have been brought on a journey against our will, without our understanding. As have you. And yet we have been brought together. Perhaps we can help each other.
Humanis smiled.
With the army of a god-king, I have journeyed through strangeness these past 6 years. And everything we have encountered, we have conquered. Whatever strange power has stirred up the world, I doubt it holds any fear for us.
But now a cry went up, rustling through the camp. People started running to the river, thousands of them moving at once, as if a wind had run over a field of grass. A messenger ran up and spoke rapidly to Eumenes and Hephaestion. Bessessa asked Morgan,
"What is it?"
"He's coming," the factor said. "He's coming at last."
"Who?"
"The king."
A small flotilla of ships sailed down the river. Most were broad, flat-bottomed barges or magnificent triremes with billowing purple sails. But the craft at the head of the flotilla was smaller, and without a sail, was pulled along by 15 pairs of oarsmen. At its stern was an awning stitched with purple and silver. As the boat neared the camp, the awning was pulled back to reveal a man, surrounded by attendants, lying on what looked like a gilded couch. A muttering ran through the watching crowd. Bessessa and De Morgan, forgotten by all but their guards, pressed with the rest toward the shallow bank. Bessessa said,
"What are they saying now?"
"That it's a trick," De Morgan said. "That the king is dead. That this is merely his corpse being returned for burial."
The boat put into the shore. Under Hephaestion's command, a team of soldiers ran forward with a kind of stretcher. But to general astonishment, the figure on the couch stirred. He waved the stretcher-bearers away, and then slowly, painfully, with the help of his white-robed attendants, he got to his feet. The crowds on the banks, all but silent, watched his painful struggle. He was wearing a long-sleeved tunic and a cloak of purple and a heavy cuirass. The cloak was inlaid and edged with gold, and the tunic ornately worked with patterns of sunbursts and figures. He was short, stocky, like most of the Macedonians. He was clean-shaven, and he wore his brown hair brushed back from a center parting and long enough to touch his shoulders. His face, if weather-beaten red, was strong, broad, and handsome, and his gaze steady and piercing. And as he faced the gathering on the bank, he held his head oddly, tilted a little to the left, so that his eyes were uplifted and his mouth was open.
"He looks like a rock star," Bessessa whispered. "And he holds his head like Princess Diana. No wonder they love him."
A new muttering began to spread through the crowd.
"It's him," De Morgan whispered. "That's what they are saying."
Bessessa glanced at him and was startled to see tears in his eyes.
"It is him. It is Alexander himself. By God, by God."
The cheering started, spreading like fire through dry grass, and the men waved their fists and their spears and swords. Flowers were thrown, and a gentle rain of petals settled over the boat. 20. The City of Tents. At dawn, 2 days after his departure, the Mongol envoy returned. The cosmonaut's fate, it seemed, had been decided. Sable had to be prodded awake. Volia was already alert, his eyes gritty with sleeplessness. In the musty dark of the yurt, where children snored gently in their cots, the cosmonauts were given breakfast of a little unleavened bread and a bowl of a kind of hot tea. This was aromatic, presumably made from steppe herbs and grasses, and was surprisingly refreshing. The cosmonauts moved stiffly. They were both recovering quickly from their orbital sojourn, but Kolya longed for a hot shower or even to be able to rinse his face. They were led out of the yurt and allowed a toilet break. The sky was brightening, and the customary lid of cloud and ash seemed comparatively light today. Some of the nomads were paying their respects to the dawn, with genuflections to the south and east. This was one of their few public displays of religious feeling. The Mongols were shamanists, eschewing public rituals for oracles, exorcisms, and magic displays in the privacy of their yurts. The cosmonauts were led to a small group of men. They had saddled up half a dozen horses and had harnessed two more to a small wooden-wheeled cart. The horses were stocky and undisciplined-looking, like their owners. They looked around impatiently, as if eager to get this chore over with.
"At last we're out of here," Sable grunted earnestly. "Civilization, here we come."
"There is a Russian saying," Kolya warned. "Out of the frying pan."
"Russian my ass."
The cosmonauts were prodded toward the cart. They had to climb aboard, hands still bound. As they sat down on the bare floor, a Mongol man, strong-looking even by the standards of these people, approached them and began to harangue them loudly. His leathery face was creased like a relief map.
Sable said, "What's he saying?"
"No idea. But we've seen him before, remember. I think this is the chief. His name is Skakatai."
The chief had come to inspect them during their first hours of captivity.
"This little asshole is going to try to make capital out of us. What were those words you used?"
"Darogachi. Tengri."
Sable glared at Skakatai.
"Did you get that? Tengri. Tengri. We're ambassadors from God. And I'm not about to ride off to the pleasure dome with my arms tied behind my back. Let us loose or I'll fry your sorry butt with a thunderbolt."
Skakatai, of course, understood nothing but the fragments of Mongolian. But Sable's tone carried the day. After more mutually incomprehensible argument, he nodded to one of his sons who cut Sable's and Kolya's bonds.
"Good work," Kolya said, rubbing his wrists.
"Piece of cake," Sable said.
"Next." She started pointing at the Soyuz and at the parachute silk stacked up against one of the yurts.
"I want what's mine. Bring that silk to the cart and the stuff you stole out of the Soyuz."
It took much gesturing to get this point across, but at length, with much bad grace, Skakatai ordered his people to load up the parachute, and bits of kit were brought out of the yurt. Soon the cart was incongruously piled high with parachute, spacesuits, and other gear. Kolya checked that the emergency medical supplies and flare guns were there, and the components of the ham radio gear, their only possible line to the outside world, and Casey and the others in India. Sable rummaged through the gear and dug out a life raft. She handed it ceremonially to Skakatai.
"Here you go," she said. "A gift from heaven. When we've gone, pull this toggle like so. You dig?"
She mimed the action repeatedly until it was clear that the Mongol understood. Then she bowed and Kolya followed suit, and they clambered onto the cart. The horsemen set off, one of them leading the cart horses by a rope, and the cart lumbered into motion.
"Thanks for the mutton, Buster," Sable called back.
Kolya studied her. Bit by bit, starting from a position of utter weakness and vulnerability, she was assuming control of the situation. In the days since the landing, she seemed to have burned her fear out of herself by an effort of will. But her intensity of purpose made Kolya uneasy.
"You have nerve, Sable."
Sable grinned.
"A woman doesn't get to the top of the astronaut office without learning to be tough. Anyhow, it's nice to leave with a little more style than when we arrived."
There was a loud bang, a chorus of confused cries. Skakatai had pulled the ripcord on the raft. The Mongols stared in open-mouthed astonishment at this bright orange artifact that had exploded into existence out of nowhere. Before the village had receded into the distance, the children were starting to bounce on the raft's inflated rim. The party made remarkably rapid progress. For hours on end, the riders kept their horses moving at a trot, a pace that Kolya was sure would quickly exhaust the animals, but the horses were obviously bred for such treatment. The Mongols ate in the saddle and expected the cosmonauts to do the same. They didn't even stop for toilet breaks, and Sable and Kolya learned to keep out of the way when a rider's volley of urine was caught by the wind. As they traveled on, Kolya would sometimes glimpse sparks in the distance, floating silently above the ground. He wondered if these were examples of the eyes Casey had described in India. If so, were the eyes a worldwide phenomenon? He would have welcomed the chance to study one, but their track never brought them close, and the Mongols showed no curiosity. Before the sun had climbed to its highest, they arrived at a way station. It was just a huddle of yurts lost in the middle of the emptiness of the steppe, but several horses were tied up outside, and Collier glimpsed a herd of others moving with the silence of distance across the steppe. As they approached, the riders rang a bell, and the keepers of the station came running out. The riders quickly negotiated with the keepers, exchanged their horses, and were on their way. Sable grumbled, "I could have done with a break. The suspension on this thing is a little stiff." Collier gazed back at the station. "I think this must be the Yam."
"The what?"
"At one time, the Mongols held all of Eurasia from Hungary to the South China Sea. They kept it all unified with fast communications, a system of routes and way stations where you could change your horses. The Romans had a similar system. A courier could cross 200 or 300 kilometers in a day. This isn't exactly a road. We're just riding over empty steppe. So how do these guys know how to find this place?"
"Mongols learn to ride before they can walk," Collier said.
"Crossing this vast plain, they have to be expert navigators. They probably don't even have to think about it."
Even when night came, the Mongols rode on. They slept in the saddle, with one or two of them leading the others. Sable found the jolting of the cart kept her awake. But Collier, exhausted by two sleepless nights, overstressed, overwhelmed by the oxygen-rich air of the steppe, slept from sunset to dawn. At times, though, the riders did hesitate. They had to cross peculiar straight-line boundaries between bare, baked-dry steppe and areas of bright green grass, and other places where flowers lay scattered, wilting, and other areas stranger yet where banks of snow lay half-melted in pools of shadow. It was obvious to Collier that these suspiciously straight borders were transitions between one time slice and another, and that this steppe was stitched together from a myriad fragments drawn from different times of the year, even different eras. But just as the snow was melting in the warmth, the spring flowers were quickly wilting, and the summer grass screeds were mottled and curled. Perhaps there would be some recovery, some knitting together, Collier thought, after a full cycle of seasons. But he suspected that it would take more than a single year to assemble a new ecology from these time-shifted bits of the old. The Mongol nomads could understand none of this, of course. Even the horses bucked and whinnied as they crossed these disturbing transitions. Once the riders, evidently baffled, stopped at a sight that seemed as empty and undistinguished as the rest of the steppe. Perhaps, Collier speculated, a way station had been sighted here, and the riders couldn't imagine why they hadn't found it. The station was lost, not in space, but in time. The nomads, evidently a practical people, took this in their stride. After a brief discussion marked with much shoulder-shrugging, they moved on, but at a slower pace. Evidently, they had decided that if they couldn't rely on the way stations, they should spare the horses. In the afternoon of the second day, the character of the country began to change, becoming more broken and hilly. Now they rode through shallow valleys, sometimes fording streams, and past copses of larch and pine. It was a much more human landscape, and Collier felt relieved to be away from the oppressive, unchanging immensity of the steppe. Even the Mongols seemed to be happier. As they pushed through one small stand of trees, one brute-faced young man leaned down to pluck handfuls of wild geraniums that he attached to his saddle. The area was relatively densely populated. They passed many yurt villages, some of them large and sprawling, with smoke rising everywhere, the fine threads leaning in the prevailing wind. There were even roads, after a fashion, or at least heavily worn and rutted trails. This part of the Mongol Empire seemed to have come through the discontinuity almost intact, even though it was studded with time-slice incongruities. They came to a broad, sluggish river. A ferry had been set up here, a platform guided by ropes slung across the river. The platform was big enough for the riders, cosmonauts, horses, and even the cart to be loaded on and transferred in one go. On the far bank, they turned south, following the river. Collier saw that a second great river snaked across the countryside, glistening. They were heading for a mighty confluence. Clearly, the nomads knew where they were going. But at the foot of a hill, close to a big oxbow loop of one of the rivers, they came to a slab of stone closely inscribed. The nomads slowed and stared. Collier said grimly, "They haven't seen this before, that's clear. But I have."
"You've been here?"
"No, but I've seen pictures. If I'm right, this is the confluence of the Onon and Bulge rivers. And that monument was set up in the 1960s, I think.
So this is a little teeny time slice. No wonder these guys are staring. The script is supposed to be old Mongolian, but nobody knows for sure if they got it right. You think our escorts can read it? Probably not. Most of the Mongols were illiterate. So this is a memorial? A memorial to what? To an 800th birthday. They rode on and climbed over a last ridge. There, set out before them on a lush green plain, was another yurt village. No, not a village, Kolya realized. A city. There must have been thousands of tents, set out in a regular grid pattern, spanning hectares of ground. Some of the yurts seemed no more impressive than those in Skakatai's village, out on the steppe. But at the center was a much grander structure, a vast complex of interconnected pavilions. All this was enclosed by a wall, but there were outer suburbs, a kind of shantytown of cruder-looking yurts that huddled outside the wall. Dirt roads cut across the plain from all directions, leading to the gates in the wall. A lot of traffic moved on the roads, and inside the city itself, smoke rose from the yurts, merging into a pale brown smog that hung over the city.
Christ, said Sable. It's a tent Manhattan.
Perhaps. But on the green land beyond the city, Kolya saw vast herds of sheep, goats, and horses grazing contentedly.
Just as the legends described, he murmured. They were never anything more than nomads. They ruled the world, yet cared only about having somewhere to graze their flock. And when the time comes to move to the winter pastures, this whole city will be uprooted and moved south.
Once more the horses jolted into motion, and the party rode down the shallow ridge toward the yurt city. At the gate, a guard in a blue star-spangled tunic and felt cap held them up. Sable said, "You think our guys are trying to sell us?"
Negotiating a bribe, perhaps. But in this empire, everything is owned by the ruling aristocracy. The Golden Family. Skakatai's people can't sell us. The emperor already owns us.
At last, the party was allowed to go ahead. The guard commander attached a detail of soldiers, and Sable, Kolya, and just one of their Mongol companions, along with a cart laden with their gear, were escorted into the city. They made their way down a broad lane, heading directly for the big tent complex at the center. The ground was just churned up mud. The yurts were grand, and some were decorated in rich fabrics. But the stench was Kolya's overwhelming first impression, like Skakatai's village, but multiplied a thousandfold. It was all he could do to keep from gagging. Smell or not, the streets were crowded, and not just by Asian people. There were Chinese and perhaps even Japanese, Middle Eastern types, maybe Persians or Armenians, Arabs, even round-eyed West Europeans. The people wore finely made tunics, boots, and hats, and many had heavy jewelry around their necks, wrists, and fingers. The cosmonauts' gaudy jumpsuits attracted some eyes, as did the spacesuits and other gear piled on their cart, but nobody seemed much interested.
They are used to strangers, Kolya said. If we are right about our location in time, this is the capital of a continental empire. We must be sure not to underestimate these people.
Oh, I won't, said Sable grimly. As they neared the central complex of pavilions, the presence of soldiers became more obvious. Kolya saw archers and swordsmen armed and ready. Even those off-duty glared at the party as it passed, breaking off from their eating and gambling over dice. There must have been 1,000 troops guarding this one big tent. They reached an entrance pavilion big enough to have swallowed Skakatai's yurt whole. A standard of white yak tails hung over the entrance. There were more negotiations, and a messenger was sent deeper into the complex. He returned with a taller man, obviously Asiatic, but with startling blue eyes, and expensively dressed in an elaborately embroidered waistcoat and pantaloons. This figure brought a team of advisors with him. He studied the cosmonauts and their equipment, running his hands briefly over the fabric of Sable's jumpsuit, and his eyes narrowed with curiosity. He conversed briefly and unintelligibly with his advisors. Then he snapped his fingers, turned, and made to leave. Servants began to take the cosmonauts' goods away.
No, Sable said loudly.
Kolya cringed inwardly, but she was standing her ground. The tall man turned slowly and stared at her, wide-eyed with surprise. She walked up to the cart, took a handful of parachute fabric, and spread it out before the tall man.
All this is our property. Darugachi Tengri, comprende? It stays with us,
And this material is our gift for the Emperor, a gift from the sky.
Kolya said nervously, Sable, we really don't have a lot to lose, Kolya. Anyhow, you started this charade. The tall man hesitated. Then his face split briefly into a grin. He snapped orders, and one of his advisors ran off deeper into the complex.
He knows we're bluffing, Sable said, but he doesn't know what to make of us. He's a smart guy. If he's that smart, we should be careful.
The advisor returned with a European. He was a small, runty man who might have been about 30, but under the customary layer of grime, and with his hair and beard raggedly uncut, he was hard to tell. He studied the two of them with fast, calculating eyes. Then he spoke rapidly to Kolya.
That sounds like French, Sable said.
And so it turned out to be. His name was Basil, and he had been born in Paris. In a kind of anteroom, they were served with food and drink, bits of spiced meat and a kind of lemonade, by a serving girl. She was plump, no older than 14 or 15, and wore little but a few veils. She looked vaguely European, too, to Kolya, and her eyes were empty. He wondered how far she had been brought from home. The tall grandee's purpose soon became clear. Basil was proficient in the Mongol tongue, and was to serve as an interpreter.
They assume all Europeans speak the same language, Basil said, from the Urals to the Atlantic. But this far from Paris, it's an understandable error.
Kolya's French was quite good, better than his English, in fact. Like many Russian schoolchildren, he had been taught it as his second language. But Basil's version of French, dating only a few centuries after the birth of that nation itself, was difficult to grasp.
It's like meeting Chaucer, Kolya explained to Sable. Think how much English has changed since then. Say, but Basil must have been born a century or more before Chaucer.
Sable had never heard of Chaucer. Basil was bright, his mind flexible. Kolya supposed he wouldn't have made it so far if not. And it took them only a couple of hours to build up a reasonable understanding. Basil said he was a trader come to the capital of the world to make his fortune.
The traders love the Mongols, he said. They've opened up the East, China, Korea.
It took a while to identify the place names he used.
Of course, most of the traders here are Muslims and Arabs. Most people in France don't know the Mongols even exist.
Basil had his eye on the main chance, and he began to ask questions. Where the cosmonauts had come from, what they wanted, what they had brought with them. Sable intervened.
Listen, pal, we don't need an agent. Your job is to speak our words to, the tall man. Yelu, said Basil. His name is Yelu Tutsai. He is a Khitan.
Take us to him, Sable said simply. Though Basil argued, her tone of command was unmistakable, even without translation. Basil clapped his hands, and a chamberlain arrived to escort them into the presence of Yelu himself. They walked through corridors of felt, ducking their heads. The roofs were not built for people their height. In a small chamber in the corner of this palace of tents, Yelu was reclining on a low couch. Servants hovered at his elbow. Before him on the floor, he had spread out faded diagrams that looked like maps, a kind of compass, blocks carved into figures that looked vaguely Buddhist, and a pile of small artifacts, bits of jewelry, small coins. It was the stock in trade of an astrologer, Kolya guessed. With an elegant gesture, Yelu bade them sit down on more low couches. Yelu was patient. Forced to speak to them through an uncertain chain of translation via Basil and Kolya, he asked them their names and where they had come from. At the answer that had become their stock reply, from Tengri, from heaven, he rolled his eyes. Astrologer he might be, but he was no fool.
We need a better story, Kolya said. What do these people know of geography? Do they even know what shape the world is?
Damned if I know. Briskly, Sable got to her knees and pulled aside a felt mat, exposing dusty earth. With a fingertip, she began to sketch a rough map. Asia, Europe, India, Africa. She stabbed her finger into the heart of it.
We are here.
Kolya remembered that the Mongols always oriented themselves to the south, while Sable's map had north at the top. With that simple inversion, things became much clearer. Now, said Sable, here's the world ocean. She dragged her fingers through the dust beyond the continents, making a ridged circle.
We come from far away, far beyond the world ocean. We flew over it like birds on our orange wings. It wasn't quite true, but it was close to the truth, and Yelou seemed to accept it for now. Basil said, Yelou is asking about the yam. He has ordered riders out along all the main routes, but some are broken. He says he knows the world has undergone a great disturbance. He wants to know what you understand about this strangeness and what it means for the Empire.
We don't know, said Sable. That's the truth. We are just as much victims of this as you are.
Yelou seemed to accept this. He stood languidly and spoke again. Basil gasped with excitement.
The Emperor himself is impressed by your gift, the orange cloth, and wants to see you.
Sable's eyes hardened. Now we're getting somewhere. They stood and a party quickly formed up, headed by Yelou, with Sable, Collier, and Basil at the center, surrounded by a phalanx of tough-looking guards. Collier was rigid with fear.
Sable, we have to be careful. We're the Emperor's property, remember. He will speak only to members of his family, perhaps a few key aides like Yelou. Everybody else just doesn't count.
Yeah, yeah. Even so, we've done well, Collier. Just a few days here, and we've got this far already. Now we just have to figure the angles.
They were taken into a much grander chamber. The walls were hung with rich embroidery and tapestry. The floors covered with layers of rugs and carpets so thick they were soft to walk on. The place was crowded. Courtiers milled and beefy-looking soldiers stood around the walls, laden with weapons, glaring at the cosmonauts and everybody else, even each other. In one corner of the yurt, an orchestra played softly, a harmony of lutes. All the instrumentalists were beautiful, all very young girls. And yet for all its opulence, this was still just a yurt, Collier thought, and the prevailing stink of greasy flesh and stale milk was just as bad as in Skakatai's humble home.
Barbarians, he muttered. They didn't know what towns and farms were for, save as sources of booty. They plunder the world, but they still live like goatherds, their tents piled with treasures. And in our time, their descendants will be the last nomads of all, still trapped by their barbaric roots.
Shut up, Sable hissed.
Following Yelou, they walked slowly to the center of the yurt. Around the throne, that was the focus of this wide space, stood a number of smooth-faced young men. They looked similar. Perhaps the Emperor's sons, Collier thought. There were many women here sitting before the throne. All were handsome, though some looked as old as 60. The younger ones were quite stunningly beautiful. Wives or concubines. Yelou stepped aside and they stood before the Emperor. He looked about 60. Sitting on his ornately carved throne, he was not tall. But he was slim, upright. He looked very fit. His face was full, his features small, very Asiatic, with only a trace of grey in his hair and neatly groomed beard. He held a swatch of parachute cloth in his hand, and he regarded them steadily. Then he turned aside and muttered something to one of his advisers.
He has eyes like a cat's, said Sable. Sable, you know who this is, don't you?
Of course.
To his astonishment, she grinned, more excited than fearful. Genghis Khan watched them, his black eyes unreadable. 21. Return to Jamrud. At dawn, Bisessa was woken by the peals of trumpets. When she emerged from the tent, stretching, the world was suffused with blue-gray. All across the river delta, the trumpet notes rose up with the smoke of the night's fires. She really was in the camp of Alexander the Great. This was no dream or nightmare. But mornings were the time she missed Myra the most, and she ached for her daughter even in this astonishing place. While the king and his advisers decided what to do, Bisessa, De Morgan, and the others had spent the night at the Indus Delta camp. The moderns were kept under guard, but they were given a tent of their own to sleep in. The tent itself was made of leather. Battered, scuffed, it stank of horses, food, smoke, and the sweat of soldiers. But it was an officer's tent, and only Alexander and his generals had more luxurious accommodation. Besides, they were soldiers, and used to roughing it, all save Cecil De Morgan, and he had learned better than to complain. De Morgan had been quiet all night, in fact, but his eyes were alive. Bisessa suspected he was calculating how much leverage he could apply in his new role as an irreplaceable interpreter. But he grumbled about the Macedonian's barbaric Greek accent.
They turn C-H into G and T-H into D. When they say Philip, it sounds like Billip.
As the day gathered, Eumenes, the royal secretary, sent a chamberlain to Bessetta's tent to communicate the king's decision. The bulk of the army would stay here for now, but a detachment of troops, a mere 1,000, would make their way up the Indus Valley to Jumrud. Most of them would be shield-bearers, the shock troops who were used on such ventures as night raids and forced marches, and who were entrusted with Alexander's own safety. The king himself was to make the journey, along with Eumenes and his favorite and lover, Hephaestion. Alexander was evidently intrigued by the prospect of seeing these soldiers from the future in their bastion. Alexander's army, tempered by years of campaigning, was remarkably well-disciplined, and it took only a couple of hours for the preparations to be completed, and the orders for the march to be sounded. Infantrymen formed up with weapons and light packs on their backs. Each unit, called a decus, although it typically contained 16 men, had a servant and a pack animal to carry its gear. The animals were mostly mules, but there were a few foul-smelling camels. A couple hundred of Alexander's Macedonian cavalry would ride along with the infantry. Their horses were odd-looking little beasts. Bessetta's phone said they were probably of European or Central Asian stock, and they looked clumsy to eyes used to Arabian breeds. The horses had only soft leather shoes and would surely have quickly been ruined by being overridden on rocky or broken ground. And they had no stirrups. These short, powerful-looking men gripped their horses' flanks hard with their legs and controlled their mounts with vicious-looking bits. Bessetta and the British would travel with the Macedonian officers who walked like their troops, as did even the king's companions and the generals. Only the king was forced by his injuries to ride on a cart drawn by a team of horses. His personal physician, a Greek called Philip, rode with him. But after they had set off, Bessetta realized that the 1,000 troops with their military gear, their servants, pack animals, and officers were only the core of the column. Trailing after them was a rabble of women and children, traders with laden carts, and even a couple of shepherds driving a flock of scrawny-looking sheep. After a couple of hours marching, this ragged, uncoordinated train stretched back 0.5 kilometer. Hauling this army and its gear across the countryside involved an enormous amount of labor, unquestioned by everybody concerned. Still, once they had entered the rhythm of the march, the troopers, some of whom had already marched thousands of kilometers with Alexander, simply endured, setting one hardened foot before the other, as foot-slogging soldiers had always done. Marching was nothing new to Bessetta and the British troops either, and even De Morgan endured it in silence, with the fortitude and determination Bessetta grudgingly admired. Sometimes the Macedonians sang odd, wistful songs in strange keys that sounded out of tune to Bessetta's modern ears. These people of the deep past still seemed so odd to her, short, squat, vivid, as if they belonged to a different species altogether. When she got the chance, Bessetta studied the king. Seated on a gloriously heavy-looking golden throne, being hauled across India by animal power, Alexander was dressed in a girdle and striped tunic, with a golden diadem around the purple Macedonian hat on his head, and held a golden scepter. There wasn't much of the Greek to be seen about Alexander. Perhaps his adoption of Persian ways was more than just diplomatic. Perhaps he had been seduced by the grandeur and wealth of that empire. As he traveled, his tame prophet Aristander sat at his side, a bearded old man in a grimy white tunic and with sharp, calculating eyes. Bessetta speculated that this hand-waver might be concerned about the impact of people from the future on his position as the king's official seer. Meanwhile, the Persian eunuch called Bagoas leaned nonchalantly against the back of the throne. He was a pretty, heavily made-up young man in a kind of diaphanous toga, who from time to time stroked the back of the king's head. Bessetta was amused by the weary glares Hephaestion shot at this creature. Alexander, though, slumped on his throne. It hadn't been hard for Bessetta to figure out, with the help of the phone, just when in his career she had encountered him. So she knew he was 32, and though his body was powerful, he looked exhausted. After years of campaigning, in which he led his men into the thick of it with a self-sacrificing bravery that must have sometimes bordered on folly, Alexander bore the results of several major injuries. He even seemed to have difficulty breathing, and when he stood, it was only through extraordinary willpower. It was strange to think that this still young man had already come to rule more than 2 million square kilometers, and that history was a matter of his whim. And stranger yet to remember that in the timeline of Earth, his campaign had already passed its high watermark. His death would have been only months away, and the proud, loyal officers who followed him now would have begun the process of tearing apart Alexander's domains. Professor wondered what new destiny awaited him now. In the middle of the afternoon, the march broke, and the traveling army quickly organized itself into a suburb of the sprawling tent city of the Indus Delta. Cooking, it seemed, was a slow and complicated process, and it took some time before the fires were lit, the cauldrons and pots bubbling. But in the meantime, there was plenty of drinking, music, dancing, even impromptu theatrical performances. Traders set up their stalls, and a few prostitutes shimmered through the camp before disappearing into the soldiers' tents. Most of the women here, though, were the wives or mistresses of the soldiers. As well as Indians, there were Macedonians, Greeks, Persians, Egyptians, even a few exotic souls whose origin Bisessa barely knew, like Scythians and Bactrians. Many of them had children, some as old as 5 or 6, their complexions and hair colors betraying their complicated origins. And the camp was filled with the incongruous noise of wailing babies. In the night, Bisessa lay in her tent, trying to sleep, listening to the crying of babies, the laughing of lovers, and the mournful, drunken wailing of homesick Macedonians. Bisessa had been trained for missions where you were flown in over a few hours, and that usually didn't last more than a day away from base. But Alexander's soldiers had walked out of Macedonia and across Eurasia, traveling as far as the northwest frontier. She tried to imagine how it must have been to have followed Alexander for years, to have walked to places so remote and unexplored that his city army might as well have been campaigning on the moon. After a few days of the march, there were complaints of peculiar sicknesses among the Macedonians and their followers. These infections hit hard, and there were some deaths, but the crude field medicine of Bisessa and the British was able to diagnose them and, to some extent, treat them. It was obvious to Bisessa that the British and she had brought bugs from the future to which the Macedonians had no immunity. The Macedonians had been subject to many novel plagues during their odyssey, but the far future was a place even they hadn't breached. It was probably lucky for all concerned that these infections quickly died out. There was no sign of reverse infections of the British by bugs carried by the Macedonians. Bisessa imagined an epidemiologist would work up an academic paper about that chronological asymmetry. Day by day, the march went on, guided by Alexander's own scouts and the careful surveys he had had made of the Indus Valley. They followed a different route back to Jumrud than that taken by Bisessa on the way down. One day, no more than a couple of days out of Jumrud, they came to a city that none of them recognized. The march halted, and Alexander sent a party of scouts to investigate, accompanied by Bisessa and some of the British. The city was well laid out. About the size of a large shopping mall, it was based on 2 earth mounds, each walled by massive ramparts of hard-baked mud brick. It was a well-planned place, with broad, straight avenues set out according to a grid system. And it looked to have been recently inhabited. But when the scouts passed cautiously through its gates, they found nobody within, no people at all. It wasn't old enough to be a ruin. It was too well preserved for that. Such features as wooden roofs were still intact. But the abandonment was not recent. The few remaining bits of furniture and pottery were broken. If any food had been left behind, the birds and dogs had long taken it away, and everything was covered by rust-brown, drifting dust. De Morgan pointed out a complicated system of sewers and wells. "We'll have to tell Kipling," he said with dry humor. "A big fan of sewers is Ruddy. The mark of civilization," he says. The ground was heavily trampled and rutted. When Bisessa dug her hand into the dust, she found it was full of flotsam. Bits of broken pottery, terracotta bangles, clay marbles, figurine fragments, bits of metal that looked like a trader's weights, tablets inscribed in a script unknown to her. Every square centimeter of the ground seemed to have been heavily trodden, and she walked on layers of detritus, the detritus of centuries. This place must be old, a relic of a time deeper than the British, deeper even than Alexander's foray, old enough to have been covered by the drifting dirt by her own day. It was a reminder that this bit of the world had been inhabited, indeed civilized, for a long, long time, and that the depths of time, dredged by the discontinuity, contained many unknowns. But the town had been emptied out, as if the population had just packed up and marched away across the stony plain. Eumenes wondered if the rivers had changed their courses because of the discontinuity, and the people had gone in search of water. But the abandonment looked too far in the past for that. No answers were forthcoming. The soldiers, Macedonian and British alike, were spooked by the empty, echoing place, this Marie Celeste of a town. They didn't even stay the night before moving on. After several days' march, Alexander's train arrived at Jamrud, to astonishment and consternation on all sides. Still on crutches, Casey hobbled out to meet Bessessa and embraced her.
I wouldn't have believed it. But jeez, the stink!
She grinned.
That's what a fortnight eating curry under a leather tent does for you.
Strange. Jamrud seems almost like home to me now. Rudyard Kipling and all. Casey grunted.
Well, something tells me it's all the home you and I are going to have for a while, for I don't see any sign of a way back yet.
Come on up to the fort.
Guess what Abdelkader managed to set up? A shower! Just to show heathens have their uses. The smart ones, anyhow.
At the fort, Abdelkader, Ruddy, and Josh crowded around her, eager for her impressions. Josh was predictably glad to see her, his small face creased by smiles. She was pleased to get back to his bright, awkward company. He asked, "What do you think of our new friend, Alexander?" Assessor said heavily, "We have to live with him. His forces outnumber ours. I mean, Captain Groves, by maybe 100 to 1. I think for now that Alexander is the only show in town."
"And," said Ruddy silkily, "Assessor undoubtedly thinks that Alexander is a fine fellow for his limpid eyes and his shining hair that spills over his shoulders."
Josh blushed furiously.
Ruddy said, "What about you, Abdi? It's not everybody who gets to confront such a deep family legend."
Abdelkader smiled and ran his hand over his blonde hair.
"Maybe I'll get to shoot my great-to-the-nth grandfather and prove all those paradoxes wrong after all."
But he wanted to get down to business. He was keen to show Bessessa something, and not just his patent shower.
"I took a trip back to the bit of the 21st century that brought us here, Bessessa. There was a cave I wanted to check out."
He led her to a storeroom in the fort. He held up a gun, a big rifle. It had been wrapped in dirty rags, but its metal gleamed with oil.
"There was an intelligence report that this stuff was here," he said. "It was one of the objectives for our mission in the Bird that day."
They were flashbang grenades, a few old Soviet-era grenades. He bent and picked one up. It was like a soup can mounted on a stick.
"Not much of a stash, but here it is."
Josh touched the barrel of the gun cautiously.
"I've never seen such a weapon. It's a Kalashnikov, an antique in my day. A weapon left over from the Soviet invasion, which is to say maybe 50 years before our time. Still works fine, I should imagine. The hill fighters always loved their Kalashnikovs. Nothing so reliable. They don't even have to clean it, which many of those boys never bothered to do."
21st century killing machines, Ruddy said uneasily. Remarkable.
The question is, the assessor said, what to do with this stuff? Could we justify using 21st century guns against, say, an Iron Age army, no matter what the odds?
Ruddy peered at the gun.
Assessor, we have no idea what waits out there for us. We did not choose this situation. And whatever manner of creature or accident has stranded us here did not take much notice of our welfare.
I would say nice moral questions are beside the point.
And that pragmatism is the order of the day. Wouldn't it be foolish not to preserve these muscles of steel and gunpowder?
Josh sighed. "You're as pompous as ever, Ruddy, my friend. But I have to agree with you." Alexander's army unit set up its camp half a kilometer from Jamrud. Soon the fires were lit, and the usual extraordinary mixture of military base and traveling circuits established itself. That first evening there was a great deal of suspicion between the two camps, and British and Macedonian troops patrolled up and down an implicitly agreed border. But the ice began to break on the second day. It was Casey who started it, in fact. After spending some time in the border zone, facing down a short, squat Macedonian veteran who looked about 50, Casey, with gestures, challenged him to a milling. Bessessa knew what this was about. A tradition among some military units where you joined in a 1-minute, no-rules, no-holds-barred boxing match and simply tried to beat the living shit out of your opponent. Despite his aggression, it was obvious to everybody that one-legged Casey was in no shape for such a contest, and Corporal Batson stepped into the breach. Stripped of trousers and braces, the Geordie might have been a twin of the squat Macedonian. A crowd quickly gathered, and as the contest was joined, the baying at each side for its champion rose up.
It's stuck in, Joe! A-la-la-la-lie!
Casey timed the contest, breaking it up after its regulation minute, by which time Batson had taken a lot of blows to his body, for the Macedonian's nose looked broken. There was no clear winner, but Possessa could see a grudging respect had been established, the crude regard of one fighting soldier for another, just as Casey had intended. There was no shortage of volunteers for the next match. When one sepoy came away with a broken arm, the officers stepped in. But a new sporting contest began at the Macedonian's suggestion, this time a game of sphera. This Macedonian tradition turned out to be a game played with a leather ball, a pick-up-and-run affair a bit like British rugby or American football, but a lot more violent. Again, Casey got involved, marking out the pitch, agreeing to rules, and acting as referee. Later, some of the Tommies tried to teach the Macedonians the rules of cricket. Bowlers hurled a hard cork ball, battered by overuse, down a strip of dirt marked by sets of improvised stumps, and batsmen swung homemade bats with abandon. Bessessa and Ruddy paused to watch. The game went well, even if the rule of leg before wicket was a challenge to the Tommies' miming skills. All this went on right beneath a floating eye. Ruddy snorted.
The human mind has a remarkable capacity to swallow strangeness.
One wild drive sent the ball flying into the air, where it collided with the hovering eye. It sounded as if the ball had hit a wall of solid rock. The ball bounced back into the hands of a fielder who raised his hands in triumph at his dismissal of the batsman. Possessa saw that the eye was quite unperturbed by this clout. The cricketers gathered into an arguing knot. Ruddy pulled his nose.
As far as I can tell, they are arguing about whether a bounce off the eye constitutes a valid catch.
Possessa shook her head. I never understood cricket. Thanks to all these initiatives, by the end of that second day, much of the tension and mute hostility had bled away, and Possessa wasn't surprised to see Tommies and sepoys slipping into the Macedonian camp. The Macedonians were happy enough to exchange food, wine, and even souvenirs like boots, helmets, and Iron Age weapons for glass beads, mouth organs, photographs, and other trinkets. And it seemed that some of the camp prostitutes were prepared to offer their services to these wide-eyed men from the future for no payment at all. On the third day, Eumenes sent a chamberlain to the fort, who summoned Captain Grove and his advisers into the presence of the king. 22. The map. It was the dirt that Kolya hated most. After a couple of days in the tent city, he felt as filthy as a Mongol himself, and as lice-ridden. In fact, he believed the parasites were homing in on him, a source of untapped fresh meat. If the food poisoning didn't kill him, he'd probably be bled to death. But Sable said they had to fit in.
"Look at Ye Lu," she said. "He's a civilized man. You think he grew up covered in shit? Of course not. And if he can stand it, you can."
She was right, of course, but it didn't make life with the Mongols any easier. Genghis Khan, it seemed, was a patient man. Something incomprehensible had happened to the world, and whatever it was had fractured the Mongol Empire, as was shown by the severing of the Yam, the great empire-wide arteries of way stations and couriers. Well, Genghis Khan had built an empire once, and whatever the state of the world, he would do it again, he or his able sons. Ye Lu, however, was advising Genghis Khan to wait. It was always the Mongol way to allow information to be gathered before determining which way to strike, and Genghis Khan listened to his advisers. During this period of deliberation, though, Genghis Khan was aware of the need to keep his troops fit and occupied. He set up a rigorous program of training, including long forced marches and rides. And he ordered a battue to be organized. This would be a mighty hunt spanning kilometers, and it would take a week to organize. It would be an exercise in maneuvering troops, using weapons, maintaining discipline, communications, and hardship. It was a significant event. The hunt was at the core of the Mongols' self-image, as well as their military methods. Sable, meanwhile, explored the yurt city. She particularly targeted the troops, hoping to learn how they fought. The Mongol warrior saw Sable as an irritation. Kolya learned that given that the usual pattern of courtship here was to kidnap your wife from the yurt of your neighbor, women had surprising influence in Mongol society, as long as they were members of the Golden Family anyhow. Genghis Khan's first wife, Borte, about the same age as the emperor, was a key voice in the decision-making of the court. But women didn't fight. The warriors were wary of this strange heaven woman in her orange clothes, and they weren't about to submit to her inspections. The turning point came when one cavalryman, drunk on rice wine, forgot about the power of heaven and tried to rip open Sable's jumpsuit. He was a stocky, powerful man, a veteran of the Mongols' first Russian campaign, and so probably personally responsible for hundreds of deaths. But he was no match for 21st century martial arts disciplines. With one pale breast exposed, Sable floored him in seconds and left him screaming on the ground with a leg broken in two places. After that, Sable rapidly grew in stature and in aura. She was allowed to come and go where she pleased, and she took care to ensure that the tale of her victory, suitably embellished, found its way back to the court. But the Mongols were growing nervous of her, Kolya saw, and that surely wasn't a good thing. Come to that, he was nervous of her. Her fear had long burned away, and as the days wore by and she pushed against one barrier or another with impunity, she grew in confidence and determination. It was as if her stranding in this bit of the 13th century had liberated something primeval inside her. Kolya, meanwhile, spent his time with Yelu, the emperor's chief administrator. Born in one of the neighboring nations, Yelu had been brought into the Mongol camp as a prisoner. An astrologer by training, he had quickly risen in this empire of illiterates. Yelu and other educated men in the court had been appointed by a far-sighted Genghis Khan to administer the growing empire. Yelu had used China as his model for the new state. He selected the most able of the prisoners the Mongols brought back from their raids into northern China to help him in this project, and extracted books and medicines from their booty. Once, he said modestly, he had been able to save many lives during an epidemic in Mongolia by using Chinese medicines and methods. Yelu sought to moderate the Mongols' cruelty by appealing to higher ambitions. Genghis Khan had actually considered depopulating China to provide more pasture for his horses, but Yelu had deflected him. The dead don't pay taxes, he had said. Kolya suspected his long-term ambition was to civilize the Mongols by allowing the sedentary cultures they conquered to assimilate them. Just as China had absorbed and acculturated previous waves of invaders from the northern wastes. Kolya had no idea how his personal adventure would turn out. But if he was stuck here on Mir, in people like Yelu, he saw the best hope for the future. And so he was happy to consult with Yelu about the nature of the new world, and to draw up plans for what to do about it. Yelu had been taken by Sable's first attempt to sketch a world map on the dirt floor. He and Kolya now assembled a detailed map of the entire world, based on Kolya's memories and charts from the Soyuz. Yelu was an intelligent man who had no difficulty accepting that the world was a sphere. Like the Greeks, Chinese scholars had long ago pointed out the curving profile of the Earth's shadow, cast on the moon during a lunar eclipse. And it was easy for him to grasp the mapping of a globe's surface to a flat sheet. After some preliminary sketching, Yelu assembled a team of Chinese scribes. They began work on an immense silk version of the world map. When finished, it would cover the floor of one of the yurts in the emperor's great pavilion. Yelu was fascinated by the emerging image. He was intrigued how little remained of Eurasia for the Mongols to conquer. From the Mongols' continent-spanning point of view, it seemed a short step from Russia through the countries of Western Europe to the Atlantic coast. But Yelu worried about how he would present the map to Genghis Khan, with so many territories in the New World, the Far East and Australasia, Southern Africa and Antarctica, of which Genghis Khan had had no knowledge. The scribe's work was truly beautiful, Kolya thought, with the ice caps picked out in delicate white threads, spun gold following principal rivers, precious stones marking major cities, and the whole covered with careful Mongol lettering. Although Kolya learned to his surprise that the Mongols had had no written script at all before Genghis Khan, who had adopted the script of his neighbors the Uyghurs as his standard. The laboring clerks clearly took pride in their work, and Yelu treated them well, congratulating them on their prowess. But the clerks were slaves, Kolya learned, captured during the Mongols' raids on the Chinese nations. Kolya had never met slaves before, and he couldn't help but be fascinated by them. Their posture was always submissive, their eyes dropped, and the women especially cringed from any contact with the Mongols. Perhaps they were favored in the presence of Yelu, but they were defeated, owned. Kolya missed his home, his wife, his children, lost in the time streams. But each of these wretched slaves had been ripped from her home, her life trashed. And not by a godlike manipulation of time and space, but simply through the cruelty of other human beings. The slave's plight didn't make his own loss any easier to bear, but it warned him against self-pity. If he found the presence of the slave clerks difficult to accept, Kolya took comfort in the civilized intelligence of Yelu. After a time, it seemed to him that he was finding it easier to trust Yelu, a man from the 13th century, than Sable, a woman of his own time. Sable grew impatient with the careful mapping session, and she was not impressed with the plans Yelu was tentatively assembling to present to Genghis Khan. The first priority ought to be consolidation, in Yelu's view. The Mongols had come to rely on the import of grain, cloth, and many other essentials, and so trade had become important to them. As there were a few working links left with China, the first and richest part of Genghis Khan's Asiatic Empire ought to be explored first. At the same time, Kolya urged, a party should be sent to the valley of the Indus to seek out Casey and the other refugees from his own time. But this wasn't bold enough for Sable. After a week, she walked into Yelu's chamber and stabbed a knife into the world map. The slave clerks fluttered away like frightened birds. Yelu regarded her with cold interest. Kolya said, Sable, we are still strangers here. Babylon, she said. She pointed to her knife, which quivered at the heart of Iraq. That's where the Khan should be directing his energies. Grain stores, trade routes, the cowing of Chinese peasants. All these are dirt compared to that. Babylon is where the true power behind this new world lies. As you know as well as I do, Kolya, a manifestation of a power that has torn up space and time themselves. If the Khan gets hold of that, then his divine mission to rule the planet might come about after all, even in his lifetime. In English, incomprehensible to any of their interpreters, Kolya said, Power like that in the hands of Genghis Khan. Sable, you're crazy. She looked at him, eyes blazing. We're 8 centuries ahead, remember. We can harness these Mongols. She waved her hand over the world map as if laying claim to it. It would take generations for anything like a modern civilization to be built on the fragments of history we have inherited. With the Mongols behind us, we could shortcut that to less than a lifetime. Kolya, we can do this. In fact, it's more than an opportunity. It's a duty.
Before this fierce woman, Kolya felt weak. But this is a raging horse you're trying to ride.
Yelu leaned forward.
Through Basil, he said, you will speak in the common tongue.
They both apologized, and Kolya repeated a sanitized version of the cosmonauts' discussion. Delicately, Yelu plucked the knife out of the gleaming map and picked at the damaged threads. To Sable, he said, your case is not made. Perhaps we could close our hand on the beating heart of the new world, but we cannot maintain that grip if we starve.
She shook her head. I will take this to the Khan. He would not be so timid as to pass by an opportunity like this.
Yelu's face closed up, the nearest Kolya ever saw to him growing angry.
Emissary of heaven, you do not yet have the ear of Genghis Khan.
Just wait,
Sable said in English, and she grinned defiantly, apparently without fear. 23. Conference. Answering Alexander's summons, they headed for the king's tent. Captain Grove and his officers, Assessor Abdikadir, Cecil de Morgan in his role as interpreter, and Ruddy and Josh, who would record this astonishing conference in their notebooks. On the Macedonian side, there would be Alexander himself, Eumenes, Hephaestion, the king's doctor Philip, and an inordinate number of courtiers, advisers, chamberlains, and pages. The setting was magnificent. Alexander's official tent, hauled all the way from the delta, was immense, supported by golden columns and roofed with spangled cloth. Silver-legged sofas had been set up before the king's golden throne for the visitors. But the atmosphere was tense. There must have been 100 troops standing alert throughout the tent. The infantrymen known as shield-bearers, dressed in scarlet and royal blue, and immortals from Persia in beautifully embroidered, if impractical, tunics. Eumenes, seeking to minimize unnecessary friction, had quietly briefed the setter on the protocol expected in the king's presence. So, on entering, the visitors from the future paid the king proskynesis, a Greek name for a Persian form of obeisance that involved blowing a kiss at the king and bowing. Abdelkadir was predictably uncomfortable with this, but Captain Grove and his officers were unfazed. Evidently, these British, stuck out on the edge of their own empire and surrounded by petty princes, rajahs, and amirs, were accustomed to respecting eccentric local customs. Aside from that, Possessa could see that Abdelkadir was enjoying himself hugely. She had met few people as hard-headed as Abdelkadir, but he was obviously indulging himself in a pleasant fantasy that these magnificent Macedonians were indeed his ancestors. The party settled on the magnificent couches, pages and ushers circulated with food and drink, and the conference began. The translation, channeled by Greek scholars and De Morgan, was slow and sometimes frustrating. But they got there steadily, sometimes with the aid of maps, drawings, or even lettering scrawled on Macedonian wax tablets, or on bits of paper Ruddy or Josh ripped out of their notebooks. They started with a sharing of information. Alexander's people were not surprised by Jamrud's evil eye, which continued to hover over the parade ground. Since the day on which the sun had lurched across the sky, as the Macedonians put it, their scouts had seen such things all over the Indus Valley. Like the British, the Macedonians had quickly become used to these silent, floating observers, and treated them just as disrespectfully. Hard-headed Secretary Eumenes was less interested in such silent mysteries than in the politics of the future, which had brought these strangers to the frontier. It took some time to make Eumenes and the others understand that the British and Bessessi's party were actually from two different eras, that the gap between them, a mere 150 years or so, was dwarfed by the 24 centuries between Alexander's time and Bessessi's. Still, as Captain Grove sketched in the background to the 19th century Great Game, Eumenes showed his quick understanding. Bessessi had expected her 21st century conflict to be less comprehensible to the Macedonians, but when Abdelkadir talked about Central Asia's oil reserves, Eumenes spoke. He remembered that on the banks of a river in what Possessor gathered was modern-day Iran, two springs of a strange fluid had welled out of the ground near where the royal tent had been pitched. "It was no different in taste or brightness from olive oil," said Eumenes, "though the ground was unsuited to olive trees." Even then, he said, Alexander had mused on the profit to be made out of such finds, if they were extensive, though his tame prophet Aristander had declared the oil an omen of hard labor ahead. "We come here in our different times, for our different ambitions," said Eumenes. "But still we come, even across millennia. Perhaps this is the cockpit of the world for eternity." Alexander himself spoke little. He sat on his throne with his head propped on one fist, eyes half-lidded, occasionally looking up with that odd, head-turned, beguiling shyness. He left the conduct of the meeting largely to Eumenes, who struck Possessor as a very smart cookie, and to Hephaestion, who would interrupt Eumenes, seeking clarification or even contradicting his colleague. It was obvious that there was a lot of tension between Eumenes and Hephaestion. But perhaps Alexander was content for these potential rivals to be divided, Bessessa speculated.